Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name's Ed.
And I'm Amanda.
We're here at Words on the Waves, and today we have an interview with Darren Ricks and Craig Cormick, and they are the authors of Warra Warra Why.
And when you look at the cover of this book, it's absolutely plastered in little award stickers,
yeah,
right?
So it's a wine bottle.
Yeah, it looks like a wine bottle. It's been critically acclaimed.
And this is a fascinating concept. They went up and down the Australian coast and visited all of the places that Captain Cook went at the time of colonisation and spoke to the communities there about what had been passed down as their stories and their oral history.
And I suppose from an Australian history point of view, perhaps one of the first times we're hearing some of these stories from the Indigenous communities about that period of time. What most children in Australia have been taught was settlement.
So we spoke to them about that experience. And here is our conversation with Darren Ricks and Craig Cormick. Well, we're here at Words on the Waves with Darren Ricks and Craig Cormick. Nice to meet you both.
How are you?
And you're about to go into your panel or your discussion on how Indigenous Australians discovered Captain Cook, which is a very provocative title. And you're here to talk about your book that you've worked on together called Warra Warra Why. Tell us a little bit about that.
So the concept of the book began fairly simple, which was, let's look at the places Captain Cook named and find their real names, find Aboriginal names. And the story goes that, you know, Michelangelo, when he's painted the Sistine Chapel, he supposedly said, yeah, I'll just put an angel in each corner, and then added and added, and 3 years later, he was still up there. So the book was a little bit like that. It grew and grew and grew, but in the end, we travelled the whole east coast of Australia, from the bottom of Victoria right up the Torres Strait Islands, and collected all these stories from mob about either Cook or colonisation or what had happened at contact and settlement. And, you know, a lot of mobs said to us, they said, yeah, we've got a Cook story, yeah. But what we really want to talk about is truth-telling. We want to tell you about what happened to our mob in the early days. So, you know, a lot of people, their history hadn't ever really been recorded easily. So the stories were quite amazing.
So you had the experience of those stories coming up for the first time, maybe, and have been discussed in those communities but never actually surfaced before. This is the first time they're coming to light for the wider view.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of them were handed down for a generation to generation. So a lot of them held those stories for 100 years, maybe, or 150, and ended up telling us their stories and about their lands and how they were taken off their land and brought back onto their country and how they had to relearn their Dreamtime stories, songlines, food, gathering, everything within Aboriginal society.
So do you have your own story that you shared for the book as well, like that's been passed down to you?
Yeah, well, I grew up on the south coast of New South Wales, down in Yuin country. So I knew a bit of the stories of sacred sites and stuff. So when we got to speak to the knowledge holders of that country, I had an understanding anyway of that land mass, but not so much Queensland and some parts of Bundjalung, like this area, Darkinjin, and all that. So,
did you find that the story changed in different areas dramatically, or were we getting consistent through line?
Pretty consistent in totem-wise, like totems of people's clans and tribes, food, the seasons of when they'd collect certain seafood, when the flowers are blooming in country, in the mountains, they'd all travel to the coast and collect crayfish if the red flower was coming out in the mountains, and yellow. So they had different colours for the flowers that would bloom in spring or autumn or summer, and they'd make their way to the coast. They knew when to make their way to the coast when fish were travelling in schools or lobsters were plenty.
Yeah, right.
So they read the country pretty well.
Yeah, and so a lot of people had, you know, Darren, you can hear from his voice, he's Indigenous, and a lot of people in remote communities. One question we'd often get asked, we'd come in, people say, okay, so which university are you fellas from? And we say, yeah, we're not from a university, actually. Oh, okay. Which government department are you fellas from? We say, no, I'm not from a government department. And where the hell are you fellas from?
Yeah, what are you doing here?
Yeah, that's it, pretty much. And we explain what we're doing. Most of them had never had an Indigenous person come and talk to them and quiz them. So it made for a different one-on-one relationship. And we had a sort of pass interview test, you might say. We weren't just given information off the bat. We had to convince people we were genuine and you know, really convince them we're going to be respectful to their stories and so on.
And trust.
And trust and so on. It had to be established beforehand, before they would do that. And, you know, some of the stories were then taken out of the book afterwards because people said afterwards, you know, retrospect, yeah, no. And so we said, that's fine, it's out.
And what had been the experience in the past for those communities with government and universities coming and visit them? Was there always an ulterior motive that they were sceptical of?
Archives.
Yeah, so the challenge was that, you know, the reference is to Joseph Banks, and Joseph Banks went up the coast and he took flowers and plants and artefacts and foods and waters without permission and stole them and took them away. And anthropologists do the same. They come and take stories and histories and they take them away. And the people never say anything. So we had an ethos we developed early was that people would always be paid for their cultural consultation if it was appropriate. And we'd always bring the stories back to them and say, you go through it and tell us what we got right, got wrong, and what you want to share and don't. So rather than saying we're the authors, we were the, I guess, the custodians of the stories in this book. And we talked to about
70
people.
Okay.
You know, it grew and grew and grew as we went up. Though also of interest is as Cook travelled up the coast, they sent smoke signals ahead saying he was coming, you know, saying Modern was coming. And the same as we got further up Queensland. Oh, yeah, we've heard of you too. Yeah, words passed along the line, yeah.
How do those smoke signals get sent now via satellite?
That's right, yeah. SMS and WhatsApp.
Yeah.
We don't wait for you guys to turn up.
Yeah. Right.
Well, did you find they were a little bit more trusting once you got there?
If word had passed along. It did. It worked as reference, you say, Darren, that people would say, yeah, because you talked to that mob and they were comfortable with what you did. So, you know, they said, yeah, they were all right.
And what has been the reception of those people to the book? Have you taken the book back to them and have they been happy?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of the liaison back, sent copies of the book back to everyone. They were promised they'd get a copy of the book. And some of them said, you know, no one's ever told our mob story in like 25 pages, 30 pages. And if someone had written a university thesis, it's behind a paywall. And all of us said, our young fellas can read that.
Yeah.
You know, young fellas who don't have great necessary literacy skills, they can read 25, 30 pages and they can know our dreaming story, they can know our culture, they can know what happened at contact and they can really feel pride in it. So it was a really nice feeling when people gave us that type of feedback.
Give feedback,
So is there a consistent sort of view of that time, that period of time, or is it something that it just comes with all different perspectives?
Yeah, what would you think, Darren, that everyone's sort of a bit focused on their land, their mob, their own history?
Yeah, a lot of them were.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they'd extend into other tribes because they're part of that tribe as well, so they'd share a bit from that tribe and share a bit from another tribe. So they held their old pride within their culture. In their country.
You mentioned truth-telling as well as being important, and that's a term that is thrown around a lot these days. What does that mean to the people that you spoke to? What's important to them when it comes to truth-telling?
What was important to them was getting their voice out there and talking about their ancestors, what their ancestors seen happen to their people and their country, and just reclamation of their language and their going back to country and stuff. So the truth telling was dispossession and colonisation of their country, especially as we got up in the Queensland more.
I think historically, when we talk about colonisation or what have you, the message is that it was all very peaceful, you know, and that we all just came together and shared. That's kind of been the messaging that's been taught in schools up until probably quite recently. So what is the alternative perspective on that? What is the other view?
So the historians, even like Linda Ryan from the University of Newcastle, just here, bless her, she's passed away now. She did a deep dive into, you know, trying to do an estimate of numbers of people who were killed. And more Indigenous people were killed by settlers than their cohorts, than were killed in World War One.
Wow.
And yet we have these massive memorials and Anzac Day commemorations to World War One, where about 60,000 Australians died. But if we consider Indigenous Australians or Australians, and we had wars on our own land, in excess of 60,000 people died in those wars, of which we're not talk too much about.
And why do you think that is? I mean, it's not that we don't ever talk about war. Like, certainly our history books are full of war and tales of conquest and all of these sorts of things. So why is it that Australian history has swept that under the rug, do you think?
I think it's been a shameful war. And, we're, you know, World War One and Anzac Day was a proudful war.
Mm.
And we have to change the way we think about that, because a lot of us are complicit one way or the other in either not sharing that story or in allowing that story to be swept away a bit. It's a narrative Australia has to come to terms with.
And when you were talking to these communities, was there a sense of pain and loss that was coming through around that time? I mean, you talked about loss of country and dispossession, what about life as well?
Well, I talked about that a lot, and we didn't put a lot of that into the book. Okay.
Because they're horrific, some of the stories.
Because they are too confronting, some of them.
And some communities, they're only there because one person survived.
Wow.
And that one person, therefore, had children married. Mm. Otherwise, the whole community wouldn't be there. So it was, pretty, very confronting.
Yeah. Mm. And what memories have been passed down of that time? Like, what surprised you you learned along the way?
We sat there and interviewed five generations in one room.
Wow.
And that what really got me and Craig thinking, oh, well, this is, they've passed their stories on to five generations of their people. So you have young people in their 20s, older people in their 40s, and then the 60s, 70s and 80s.
Mm.
And then you have a little kid who's probably 6 or 7. So when we heard that story and heard about their country and the massacre and how the river was running with blood and stuff like that, so they talk about that because they've survived.
Mm.
So they talk, their pride within their clan and their people are pretty strong.
Yeah, but Central Queensland was pretty horrific.
Really?
And it was sort of off the maps and it was away from the capital cities and it was out of sight, out of mind.
Mm.
And there was a strong ethos of, you know, it's the weekend, grab your guns, we're going out shooting. Mm. It was, absolutely appalling.
Wow.
And then we talk about the native police. We talked about a lot about the native police and who were the trackers, where were they brought from to, a lot were brought from New South Wales, Queensland, and vice versa, because, you know, you wouldn't do that to your own people.
Mm. So what was their role?
Well,
the native police is another story that Australia's really need to learn about. Yeah. So there were native police stationed over lots of parts of Australia over a couple of decades. Kids tend to be recruited. They're basically child soldiers, recruited young, give them a gun, give them a horse, give them a uniform, big man. Then you take them miles and miles and miles away from any neighbouring clan they grew up with, so they had no association with the clans you're taken to, and they'd be there to pacify the locals, which really meant going crazy. They could track better than others. We call them black trackers. They were called years later to make them seem nicer. And we met the descendants of a couple of them, and it's quite hard to your head in to know that your own ancestor was tracking mob and was probably shooting them. And so a lot of the records have been destroyed over the years, but there's enough records that have still been found and hunted down to find out what they do. So you generally have a white guy who would be the head, often our ex-Boer War guys. They're a bit traumatised really from war, and they'd have a troop underneath their control, and they'd ride into the bush and they'd clear out camps and they'd...
But what motivated that?
Clearing the land.
Land.
For the pastoralists.
Yeah. It was all about... we don't have enough of that here in Australia, do we?
No, we don't. So the pastoralists considered the Aboriginal people as a pest because they'd spear... You know, we've taken over your land. You've no longer got access to kangaroos and possums because we've shot them all, or we've cleared the land where they used to live. But there are sheep there or cows there. So Indigenous people said, well, I'm going to spear a sheep because it's on my land, you know?
Yeah.
You spear one of my sheep, then get the gang together. We're going out and stop that.
Yeah, right.
So it was really about an argument over land. Whose land was it? And, you know, the settlers presumed it was our theirs over then. And it was pretty appalling to hear those stories.
Prestige land, like the place down there, Parramatta and all that.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm wondering the people that you spoke to, like hearing all these stories, we've got trauma going back hundreds of years and all these memories that are still very fresh and not just from 200 years ago, it's like ongoing. I'm interested to know what they think about Australia today and the path that the government is taking and the direction that it's moving.
A lot of the elders said there's been a lot of change, but not enough change.
Mm-hmm.
in the country.
So they see the initiatives as positive?
Yeah, not a lot of trust in governments. A lot of promises get broken. But forgiving, which is the thing I find really humbling, you know, these communities where they've suffered so bad and they still want to work with white people and live on the land communally and they still want to. There's anger in some communities, but the sense of forgiveness that was apparent, you know, that they say, younger generation, you're not the lot who did it, so let's find a way to work together. You've got to get your school kids involved, got to get changing understanding and see how we can all live together.
And are there any views on what that might look like? Are people wanting specific things to happen, or is it just this feeling of moving towards peace?
If we were asked to look across the board, I think the Victorian model of a treaty has got a lot of people excited.
Okay.
And we've been looking at a lot of treaty, and we reckon they did the voice to Parliament completely asked about.
Okay.
So it should have been truth-telling, then a treaty, and then a representative voice in that order. If you get out of order, it doesn't work. And the reason is truth-telling lets people understand the actual situation. You hear what happened, and you think, oh, my God, I had no idea.
But that's the thing, isn't it?
That's because we were never taught this in school. We had no idea. That makes people more receptive to say, okay, we probably should have had a land agreement, particularly when you discover that Australia was the only British colony that never had a treaty. And there are up to 500 treaties signed across North America and South America everywhere, except Australia. And so why not? You know, so you discuss that. You know, okay, maybe we need to have a treaty that recognises prior sovereignty, that recognises these things. Then comes representative voices in Parliament or wherever, a representative voice that can be accepted. And that can be worked out in different locations and different places. It can differ. But we came very much to the understanding if you don't do it in that order, you fail. And that's, I think, why the voice to Parliament failed. It never raised enough awareness of why it was important, how what people had gone through.
Kind of put forward the question without providing the context.
Yeah, and people would say, well, why? What before? Why? Because it was never given.
Because we were doing the book at the time.
Yeah, we were travelling. It was very interesting.
Very mixed.
Yeah, a lot of Indigenous communities did not support the voice.
Didn't want the voice, some did.
Yeah.
So you'd have to be tread very lightly when you went into community, and we tried not to talk about it at all. But when we said we're from Canberra, they'd go, what's this?
Then they started. And
we'd say, oh, no, we're undecided.
Okay, good call.
Well, this is the interesting thing, right? Like you say, oh, there's no trust in government. Nobody trusts the government. Like, nobody trusts any government. That's the thing, right? Yes. And government initiatives are famously inefficient and ineffective or only partially effective or too late.
Indigenous people have a longer view of history than 3-year electoral cycle.
Exactly.
And they're famous for programs coming in, setting up, change government. No, we're going to change that. And it's like, it never even got off the ground.
The funding is
changed
all around. And that's the case for all forms of government initiative, but I guess some of these are more contentious than others, and those are the ones that have this roller coaster ride of funding and so on that becomes like completely stifles any attempts at progress. So it's frustrating, but it's like, okay, treaty might be a nice idea, but also why are we trusting the government necessarily to solve this problem in a productive way when we know that governments
are... most communities just want to look after their own future. They say, you know, just give us the resources and we'll manage our own welfare payments, we'll manage our own health services, we'll manage our own caring for country, we'll do ranger excursions for kids. We just got to be resourced to do that, not resourced for 3 years and then lose it.
And then you're constantly wondering when the next...
So it was... Warra Warra Wai was, we went in there as with 5 main questions to ask communities, but it grew and grew and grew. So,
did you go back to some of those communities and ask more questions?
No. Okay. We had to stick to that, but they wanted to talk about something else, so we'd have to go back to the 5 questions of asking, what's your dreamtime stories, what's your, you know, connection to your country, what's your main place on country, are you a knowledge holder or a storyteller or a song man or a song woman? So we mainly got all that, like landscapes, the traditional names of landscapes, dreamtime stories, seasons, and just everything we could
fine. Yeah, because country is so important to mob and clan, and you have to hear the stories. We wanted to start each chapter of the book, and there are 18 chapters, talking about the land, the formation of the land, Dreamtime formation, how that impacts how people relate to the land, live with it, like Darren was talking about, the floral calendars for the seasons, how people lived before settlement, then what happened at settlement, then and so on down the line. So we tried to capture that capture a bit more breadth into just the one story.
Intertwined the endeavours.
Yeah, yeah, with the
how Cook's they version. Met the traditional people in their country. Because there's one time they stayed in up in Cairns somewhere.
Cooktown.
Endeavour River.
56 days. Yeah,
56 days.
Everybody knows Botany Bay. Yeah. Only a week in Botany Bay. Yeah. They were 56 days up on the top. Right. So they got to meet the people and record their words. But it's out of remote area. Most people never heard of it.
What does that title mean?
Warra Warra Wai were the first words indigenous language spoken on the East Coast to a European. And for years they thought it meant go away. Go away. Because when Cook's boats were coming from the Endeavour, they write in the journals, they opposed, they're still on the beach, two men still on the beach opposed us and shouted, Warra Warra Wai. And they always thought it meant go away, go back. And that's how it's been recorded in the histories. But when we talked to the people, they said, no, the history books got it wrong, man. See, Cook was breaking protocol. Because when you come to a new land, you stop at the border, you wait your turn. When you're invited ashore, then you come. And Cook and his boat started coming ashore. So they were throwing rocks saying, get back. And Warra Warra Wai means you were all ghost people. You were all dead people because, you know, they were white. They stunk a bit. And so this, and up and down the coast, we got this same story that we thought they thought that were the spirits of their dead coming back.
Wow.
Because a lot of places the dead will die and go away to the west and one day come back from the east.
Oh, okay.
And they presumed. And up in like 1770, they said they watched them. They're thinking, these are our ancestors. But what happened? They've forgotten our lore and they don't understand what plants do. So what are they?
Yeah.
It took a while to figure out they were men, but not men they'd ever seen.
Yeah.
But that was a weird place, 1770.
Very weird. Even to call a place 1770 is a weird sort of thing. That's why you get its name change. Halfway up Queensland's a little tiny coastal town called 1770.
Because
Cook landed there in 1770. Yeah.
And there was a festival on at the time. We were travelling it.
Yeah.
An Aboriginal festival. So
Spent 2 days there with them all.
There. But we had to earn their trust too,
again,
mate.
Again, they had to earn the trust.
Well, it's amazing that these stories have persevered and we get that view from the people who were there passed down. And it's surprising, also not surprising, that they haven't been told or heard.
This gobsmacked us. We said, you know, it wasn't that unique an idea to go and just talk to people. And people said, oh, my God, how did you get those stories?
Yeah.
I said, we talk to people.
We just asked.
Just asked.
Yeah. Simple.
I'm surprised it hadn't been done anywhere before.
And to what extent, like, you know, we talk about truth-telling and famously with oral histories and so on, things can get embellished over time or changed depending on who's telling the story. So what was your view on that and how, I guess, true to the original experience that these stories still are hundreds of years later?
I would say from a white fella point of view, we're used to embellishment. But when you hear a First Nations person tell an oral story, it doesn't really get embellished.
Okay.
Because they have a long, long history of oral facts. And stories had to be precise because they would tell you what plants could be poisonous and they could tell you how to behave in a certain way. And there could be little bits around that were changed, but the core central facts would never alter.
Right. Right.
And we'd find that if we hear a story from one person there, another person further away, the facts parts of the story would not alter.
It'd be the same.
Same
as like men's areas and women's areas and family areas. Like you've got to know those within country as well. And they hand them things down. Orally.
And you know, we're used to the written word being gospel and oral testimony being a bit dodgy. But the indigenous communities, they don't seem
never changes that way.
I guess it's the difficulty of marrying those two ideas together because we talk about storytelling. When we think of storytelling, it's often fiction or embellished versus oral history, which we like to think is more fact-driven and the objective is to communicate fact rather than to entertain or surprise or shock people. So
they never change some
inherit parts. No,
inherit errored over generations and generation, passed down and made sure it doesn't change.
On purpose, with that intention.
And, you know, and kids are drilled, you know, tell us back that story. No, that bit's wrong.
Right.
You know?
Well, fascinating. It's great to hear these stories being told, and hopefully people keep listening.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
For spending time with us. This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.